I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Scott Shane, national security reporter for the New York Times, joins us with a story fraught with questions about U.S. drone attacks in the war on terrorism. It's the story of Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born imam who became the first U.S. citizen to be assassinated by his native country. Scott Shane joins us in the second hour of the show. Up front, Senator Ben Cardin decides to oppose the Iran nuclear deal. Europe deals with its worst refugee crisis since World War II. Labor Day comes and goes, and Donald Trump is still the leading contender for the Republican presidential nomination. And closer to home, two more candidates get into the campaign to be Baltimore's next mayor. Midday politics after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Glad you could join us. Thanks for making Midday part of your day. A lot to cover in the next 2 hours. Scott Shane is going to be with us, national security reporter from the New York Times, talking about his new book just out this month called Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. This is the story of Anwar al-Awlaki, the U.S.-born imam who was assassinated by his own country, by the U.S. In Yemen with a drone attack. Scott Shane will be joining us to talk about the life and death of Anwar al-Awlaki in the second hour of our show. We're talking politics in this hour with Melissa Deckman from Washington College. She'll be back with us in this hour, along with Richard Cross, GOP political analyst and blogger and contributor to the Baltimore Sun op-ed page, and Max Hillier, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University, joining us all in this hour to talk about a bunch of things. One is Senator Ben Cardin's decision to oppose the proposed nuclear deal with Iran. That's one item there. Europe, Western Europe facing its largest, and Eastern Europe facing its largest refugee crisis since World War II. And we'll talk some presidential politics in this hour as well. But first, some local news for you. The Baltimore Sun reporting today that the city of Baltimore has reached an agreement to pay a settlement to the family of Freddie Gray, $6.4 million, a wrongful death settlement to the family of Freddie Gray, who died from injuries sustained in police custody on April 12th. He died on April 19th. Yvonne Wenger of the Baltimore Sun joining us here to provide us with some of the news that the Sun is reporting today. Yvonne, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. So this is a proposed deal that will go to the Board of Estimates on its usual day, Wednesday, right?
That's right. This is a five-member spending panel controlled by Mayor Rawlings Blake, and they meet tomorrow at 9 a.m.
What did the mayor say, if anything, about this?
So the mayor's office is saying next to nothing outside of what was released in a brief statement. They say that to be clear, the settlement should not be interpreted as a judgment on the guilt or innocence of the officers facing trial. It is proposed solely because she says she believes it's in the best interest of the city and avoids any costly and protracted litigation.
And is the mayor going to speak about this tomorrow? Because she usually speaks to the press at the Board of Estimates.
Yeah, we're hopeful that the mayor will be able to talk to us a little bit more about why the timing for this settlement, especially as we're preparing for the second pretrial motions hearing on Thursday and well in advance of the six criminal cases that are expected to begin later this year.
That's right. Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams last week separated all six defendants in the case, the six officers, saying that they each deserve to have a separate trial. And this Thursday, he's going to decide, well, hear arguments and then decide on whether the case should be moved outside of Baltimore City. But back to this proposed settlement, Yvonne, $6.4 million. The Sun's done a lot of reporting on wrongful death settlements reached in police-involved deaths and assaults, excessive force cases. How does this compare to others that we've seen, that size?
Right, exactly. So based on extensive reporting anchored by my colleague Mark Puente, we have learned that this $6.4 million settlement is larger than the total of 120 other lawsuits combined for alleged police brutality and misconduct since 2011. So this is extremely rare. Just in April, the city awarded a family $175,000 in the death of a 38-year-old Randallstown man who was shot by police in 2012. So this is an extraordinarily large amount based on the analysis that our reporting has shown.
And swift. Freddie Gray, as I said, he died on April 19th. Today is September 8th. 2015, so that's pretty quick for a settlement. Well, thank you for that, Yvonne. Thanks for getting on the phone with us, and we'll see what else the Sun has to report on this afternoon and tomorrow. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yvonne Wenger of the Baltimore Sun staff, if you want to read the rest of the story, you can find it at baltimoresun.com. I can't help but ask my panelists in the studio for their reaction. Richard Cross, what is your thought about this? First of all, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Melissa Deckman's in the studio with me, and Max Hilaire. Nice to have you all
here.
Thank you.
I'm just curious what your reaction is to this.
Well, I guess three reactions. The first one is the timing does surprise me in light of what Yvonne Wenger said about the next activity in the trial coming up.
Yeah.
And you could also kind of raise the point as to whether or not And my colleague here at the sitting next to me, Professor Deckman, raised this off the air, whether or not this is an admission of guilt on the part of the city. Now, the mayor insists it's not.
Right.
But I think, you know, there are also two other things you could say. First, perhaps this is kind of a preemptive move to stave off violence in case the court cases don't go in favor of what some people would perceive as justice. And then I think the mayor would, and her statement may raise the point that maybe if they waited down the road, they'd pay more money than they would pay now.
If you had protracted litigation.
Yes.
Also, I doubt in a criminal case, it's hard to imagine that this information, this news would be entered into evidence, news of a settlement, would be in any way entered into evidence in a trial of the officers.
No, it's separate then, but at least the jurors privy to that information, and it may sway their thinking on the case one way or the other. But the point I wanted to make is the fact that with this going forward, how likely it is that the jurors may now think the police officers are guilty, and the impact this settlement may have on the relationship between the city and the police union.
Very good points there. Last week in arguments before Judge Williams, there was extensive elocution by the defense lawyer, lawyers plural, about pretrial publicity. And in fact, that was directed toward the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, for her statements and behavior at the time charges were announced. So there was a lot of focus on that. Ultimately, the judge didn't agree with the defense on that. But then he later also separated the six officers, a separate argument separating them at trial. Melissa Deckman?
I was just going to add, I know that there's a motion to change the venue for
the
trial
this week. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if this will have any impact on that. Will it be easier to get a more fair trial outside the city of Baltimore? I think more Baltimoreans are following this story than other Marylanders. But, you know, it's reached national news, so I'm not sure ultimately if that will have an impact. I too, like Richard, I'm sort of surprised at the timing
of it. We'll talk some more about this tomorrow on the midday show at noon. This is Midday Politics. That was Melissa Deckman of Washington College, Richard Cross with us, who blogs at Cross Purposes, and Max Hilaire, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University. So I just want to mention some other news that we were going to tackle today. This has to do with the proposed Iran nuclear deal with the U.S. and the other five.
P5+1.
Right. Okay, so last week, just going into the Labor Day weekend, we heard that Senator Ben Cardin, who is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, opposed this deal. He came under a lot of criticism from people mostly on the left and the middle, I think. You know, Republicans are in the Senate are totally opposed to this deal, as you might expect. But anyway, three Democratic senators announced today that they're going to vote in support of this deal. That brings the number to 41 senators, and the importance of that is it paves the way for a filibuster of the Republican-led efforts to criticize this deal in a resolution. That's what we're all looking at. So there's two things that are going on. One is a vote up and down on the deal, and the secondly is a sort of a Republican-led condemnation of it. Melissa.
Right. So I think politically this is important for President Obama because now with 41 Democrats saying that they support the president, it will essentially allow them to wage a filibuster. Now, I know many Americans think of filibusters as Jimmy Stewart in the classic movie where one lone senator stands at the front. And occasionally you have these stunts. People like Ted Cruz have done this in recent history and Rand Paul. But really, in reality, a filibuster can be waged by one senator, and Senate rules are made in such a way that the rest of the business of the Senate get going, and then the Senate will just never take this up for a vote. And so you need something called cloture in the Senate in order to stop a filibuster, and that is three-fifths of senators who would agree to stop a filibuster. That's 60. Now, of course, only 59 would likely vote for a cloture vote. And so President Obama is assured that there won't be a resolution passed in the Senate. He probably will have to face a resolution in the House, but at this point it doesn't matter because he's essentially won on this deal.
Yeah, the significance of Cardin's decision last week was that while the deal itself seemed to be secure, it wasn't clear whether the Democrats could stop the Republicans from this resolution criticizing it. Max?
Well, then, one, I was disappointed with Senator Cardin's decision not to support the agreement. And two, I thought as the senior ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Cardin would have provided some degree of leadership in this situation that he did not. But more importantly, I think we are talking about really nothing because this is not a treaty. This is an executive agreement. Whether the House and Senate vote against, it doesn't really matter. And even though it were to be a treaty and the Senate had voted it down, we risk losing the support of our allies, that is the P4 plus one, which is Germany, because Britain, France, they have gone ahead and reestablished diplomatic relations with Iran, China Russia. And, of course, Germany has never really severed diplomatic relations with Iran. So I think we would be the lone wolf and we would be at a disadvantage whatever we do going forward, because the Iranians are eager to re-enter the community of nations, and we would be stopping it strictly for domestic politics.
The Sun story on Senator Cardin's decision last week, Senator Cardin cited concerns with the inspections regime called for in the agreement, the difficulty world leaders may have reimposing sanctions should they need to, and the fact that Tehran will not be required to disclose its past efforts to build a nuclear weapon.
I'm not sure disclosing the past effort is really relevant. I mean, we are going forward, as the Iranians said, let's not look back at the difficult history. Let's look to the future. I think the United States and other members of the coalition have enough information on how far Iran had gotten in development of its nuclear weapons. So Iran does not really have to disclose. Israel knows, the Russians know, the British know, the French and the United States. So, I mean, we do not want to disclose how we obtain that information. So the Iranians need something to stand on as well. And I think the goal is to make sure that Iran complies with the agreement and their mechanisms in place to make sure that if the Iranians cheat, the IAEA will bring it out, and reimposing Security Council sanctions on Iran is very likely.
Before I go to Richard for his comments, one more from you, Max. Any significance to this split, Republicans and Democrats? You have a divided government here on this deal in the U.S. I know we're only one of the countries involved in this, and even if we voted it down, I'm sure it would still, the other countries would probably lift their sanctions, right? They've said they would. But anyway, any significance at all? Are Republicans playing are they being irrelevant again?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, President Bush opposed the framework agreement President Clinton signed with the North Koreans. He didn't accomplish anything in the 8 years he was in office. He called Iran one of the axis of evils. He didn't negotiate any agreement with Iran, nor could he take a military strike against Iran. And I think what we have to keep in mind, whether we like it or not, the Iranians are not that naive. I mean, we invaded Libya. Libya had weapons. They gave it up. And we invaded Libya, put Libya in a very chaotic situation as is now. We invaded Iraq, claiming that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and Iraq didn't, and we knew they didn't, right? So with Iran, had Iranians are saying, you didn't invade North Korea, and you know North Korea has the bomb, then what is the incentive for us giving it up if giving it up is going to weaken our strategic position, and hence we may end up that military option, which is still on the table, may very well be used against us. So, I mean, in negotiating, you have to give and take. And I think Secretary Kerry and the P4 plus one did an excellent job in giving away something to the Iranians in order to get them to the position they have taken right now.
Richard, what are your thoughts on this? Cardin's decision and then the deal in general.
Well, I thought Senator Cardin's kind of reaction to this whole process as it unfolded was very interesting. You got the sense that the senator was tiptoeing through a minefield, and he was very aware of that. And he was kind of elongating the process. So I guess events would kind of weigh in. I think Senator Bukulski coming out and supporting the deal gave him some cover. I thought it was interesting when he went to Johns Hopkins and met with students. Obviously, it's good when senators meet with students and interact with them. But I thought that that was kind of part of a process to kind of wait to see where things went. And then I think he was always going to kind of oppose the deal because I think it's obviously I take him at his word that he does, but also I think it serves his political interests. Now, in terms of the larger deal, I don't think there was any chance that President Obama was not going to get what he wanted. And I don't think there was any chance that the Senate was going to come out of this looking good. Where I think the debate moves on now is this issue kind of migrates into the presidential election, and it kind of feeds a larger narrative that you'll hear from some Republican candidates that the U.S. Is weak around the world, being pushed around by Russia, being pushed around by China. This feeds that narrative, rightly or wrongly, but I think that that's kind of the legacy of this whole debate.
Hmm. And Cardin faces election in 2018, 18. I note here. What does it do for him politically?
Politically, obviously, it shores up support with his kind of maybe strongest constituency, which are Jewish voters who may be more inclined to have concerns about the deal than others. So, and I think that's probably was a consideration when he weighed in, as he did.
I posted the Sun's story about Cardin's decision on Facebook today, and all of the commenters are disappointed. I'm very disappointed in this decision. Geraldine says, I'm glad Senator Mikulski got it right. Time to find someone to run for his Senate seat, says Marcia. So disappointing, so out of touch. These are comments about from various readers or listeners on my Facebook page. Al says, disappointing. He seems to have considered it very carefully and obviously knows the agreement well, but it is very disappointing. Lee says, this is a disappointment. Everyone's using this word. Doesn't he realize how many nations have signed on to this agreement? I'm sure he does.
No, I think that Ben Cardin was in between a rock and a hard place in some respects. He is the ranking minority member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, so people look to him as a leader. He also has very close ties to the Jewish community, being a Jew himself. Jews, in fact, are quite split on the deal nationally, but you know, if you look at the Republican side of the equation, Israel is a paramount concern, the safety of Israel. And so, obviously, Benjamin Netanyahu, a very big critic of this deal. But I think, in reality, the only thing that would appease Netanyahu and critics is for Iran to essentially give away all nuclear technology. And in reality, that's not going to happen. I think, as Max was pointing out, it's a negotiation, right? There has to be a give and take. And so I think that, you know, it's been interesting to watch. I think Richard's absolutely right that we're going to see in the presidential debate this will be a huge issue, and many Republicans will be talking about this.
We'll take a break here, and you can join us on Midday, Midday Politics, 410-662-8780. If you have any comments to share about Senator Cardin's decision on the nuclear deal with Iran itself. When we get back, we'll talk about the refugee crisis in Europe, and then onward to the presidential campaign. Bernie Sanders Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Ben Carson. It's a great lineup here. We'll be talking about this hour with Melissa Deckman, Richard Cross, and Max Hillier. Please join us. And welcome back to Midday Politics. Dan Roderick's here with Max Hillier from Morgan State University, Richard Cross, who blogs at Cross Purposes, former GOP press secretary, gubernatorial speechwriter, who writes an op-ed now and then for the Baltimore Sun, and Melissa Deckman from Washington College, where she's chair of the political science department. Okay, so, my goodness, the images coming from Europe over the last week or so, Syrian refugees. Amazing story here. What do we say about this, Max? How do we approach this as U.S. citizens looking at this?
There are a couple of things I want to point out that we use the word refugee very loosely in the debate, and not everyone trying to get into Europe is a refugee. Some are economic migrants. But more importantly, Europe has a law, the Dublin Agreement, where you register in the first port of entry into the EU and you seek asylum there, and if that fails, then you go back home. But you simply can't come in and register in Spain or Greece or Italy and then go to the UK or to Germany, which is what a lot of these people want to do. I've spent a significant amount of time in Central and Eastern Europe. I used to teach in Hungary. The Hungarian government is not, I don't think, is representative of the Hungarian people, at least the sentiment towards the migrants. But I think what's missing in this debate, then, is the root cause of this problem and who is responsible. This is not a European problem. I mean, Europe is bearing the brunt because Europe of the geographic proximity. But what shocks me is the relative absence of any action from the United States government. We should keep in mind most of the people are coming from Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, all four places that we, in some way or the other, have been engaged in armed conflict. Libya is dismembered. Iraq is failed. Syria is
civil
on the verge of failure. It's been
years.
A four-year civil war. Yeah. And then Afghanistan is an ongoing conflict that has not ended for the last 20-plus years. So I think we do have a responsibility. But short of taking in people, the United Nations Refugee Agency is seriously underfunded. So the countries bearing the brunt, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, very short on resources, and hence the conditions for people in the camps who've been in these camps for 2-3 years is really appalling. And then these people, out of desperation, are looking to get out of these countries and find their way to Europe.
Is there a measure of U.S. involvement in all of this in
the
last 3 years?
I think the United States is providing some humanitarian assistance for Jordan, for Lebanon, and for Turkey. But the monies for the aid agencies are simply not enough to provide the kinds of humane conditions that people need to live, to be in a refugee camp long term. I mean, 4 years in a deplorable condition, as in Jordan, where people can't leave the camp. You're virtually in prison in Jordan or Lebanon or in Turkey, and hence it forces these people to want to get out and find a better place for shelter.
Did you find it extraordinary what the German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced, that making room for 500,000 of these, I use the term refugees, that's what the term's being used generally in the news. You surprised by Melissa Deckman that she would make such an announcement?
Well, I think she's under enormous international pressure to do more. I mean, Germany is the wealthiest country in Europe. And so I think after the publication last week of that haunting picture of that 3-year-old boy who died trying to flee the Syrian war, it really raised people's consciousness about what's going on. I think most humans sort of compartmentalize war and violence going on in other countries, other nations, they don't really think about it as being related to them. I think that picture really sort of brought to stark relief a lot of the suffering that's happening, and many people would say unnecessarily, or at the hands of U.S. foreign policy and other foreign policy. So I'm not surprised that she stepped up, and she's under enormous political pressure to do that. Having said that, I think Max is right. There needs to be some sort of solution in the area, and I don't see any U.S. appetite for doing that at this point, because there are no good options currently in Syria. You have a ruthless regime that's secular, but you have Islamists who want to come in and take over. You have ISIS in the mix, and it's in the U.S. Public, I think, has no appetite for going in and getting involved in another armed conflict in the Middle East. I just don't think it's going to be happening.
That, and I connected to our attitude toward undocumented mm-hmm. immigrants in the United States. People say it's apples and oranges. Don't compare refugees with, but I will, because of this example. It was last year or the year before. Time passes so quickly. When the right. children were coming from Central America, children from small towns that were ruled by drug gangs, right? People didn't. There was a pretty harsh pushback against those children on the right, mostly. I mean, President Obama and the governor of Maryland at the time, Martin O'Malley, said, you know, we should open the doors and try to help these kids. But there was a lot of harsh pushback to that idea, the idea that they would be refugees. And I think a refugee can be a migrant who moves from one country to another because of, for political reasons, because of crime. You call them economic migrants.
I might put
that in a separate category,
yes.
as the law does, right?
Yes.
But you can be a refugee for lots of reasons. A natural disaster, another one.
Well, again, I think the Germans have sort of overlooked the definition under the Geneva Convention as to what is a refugee. And even as groups fleeing war, the entire group is not likely to be considered refugees, because it's an individual claim based on persecution mm-hmm. for race or religion or gender, whatever the case may be. And the process of interviewing these refugees to determine whether they're genuine refugees can take anywhere from 2 weeks in the Netherlands to 2 years in Hungary or in Greece or Italy. Europe doesn't have a central location except a small immigration post in Malta that is understaffed to review such large cases of people.
So you said that earlier the European Union policy is if you arrive there and claim asylum, you stay in whatever country that is until that's...
Yes, but even before this influx of people, you have large numbers of people who were at Calais in France who were in sort of they call it a jungle. These are people from Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, Ghana, Afghanistan, who were brought there by traffickers looking to go to London. Some of them risked their lives by jumping on the trains or lorries or whatever, trying to get into England. And it's a very appalling situation as well. So I think the solution, and there may not be one, as Melissa said, because the war option is not on the table. The Security Council will never get Russia to go along to support responsibility to protect, as the United Nations had agreed to previously after Rwanda and Bosnia.
Excuse me, you're saying that Russia would never go along with it?
Russia and China would not support a Security Council resolution authorizing the use of military
against
force for
ISIS?
Humanitarian
or for
reasons.
Humanitarian reasons.
Yes.
Sorry.
So whether it's to... because what happened in Libya, I don't think the Russians and Chinese were very pleased with it. That, you know, a resolution in the Security Council to provide humanitarian protection to civilians in Benghazi ended up leading to the death of the president of Libya, whether we like him or not. And the same could happen in Syria. I mean, if you want to stop a human rights situation, you either depose the leader, you put him on trial, or you assassinate him. But otherwise, you're not solving the humanitarian problem by the leader still in place.
And Max Hillier knows what he's talking about. He just wrote a book on this subject. called Waging Peace, the United Nations Security Council, and Transnational Armed Conflicts. That's Max's latest book, one of four. Now, Max will hold a book signing. See, you like this little segue I provided here for you?
Yes,
and congratulations on your fourth
thanks
book.
Thanks so much, Dan.
You're going to be at the original...
James Lewis Museum.
Oh, the James Lewis. I'm sorry, this is at Morgan.
Yes.
The James E. Lewis Museum at Morgan on September 22nd in the evening, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. with that book. Congratulations on that book again,
thanks,
Max.
Thanks again.
Richard, are we going to hear about this refugee crisis much in the political campaign? Also a little bit. I mean, someone asked Donald Trump about it. But, I mean, this is not going to be an American issue. You don't see it.
Well, if it becomes an issue, it's going to be a thorny issue because you've got that horrific picture of the child laying dead on the beach. And I think it would be very dangerous for Republicans who would be disinclined for the U.S. to play a major role here to make any political hay out of it. I think to the extent that it comes up, it winds up in kind of a mixed bag about immigration and America's role in the world. I think if America is going to be involved in this conversation, and I think it needs to be, I think President Obama is going to have to exert leadership on the humanitarian front, because foreign policy in the U.S. is so polarized right now that you won't see any sort of a common solution being advocated.
It does give Republicans an opportunity to make a distinction, whether they really believe it or not, between those seeking asylum for political reasons or natural disaster or whatever it is, and undocumented immigrants, right?
No, I think that
and Trump did that the other day.
We have a history of accepting political asylum seekers, right? And so we could make – I think that argument could be made. I think the way it impacts the GOP race is that it just feeds into a narrative that many Republicans have that Obama's foreign policy has been disastrous, that there is no foreign policy. There's no way to effectively handle ISIS and other sorts of foreign crises in the Middle East. And so I think it feeds into that larger narrative, and you'll be hearing more about that. Donald Trump, of course, has a plan. We don't know what it is to defeat ISIS. We're still waiting to hear. But but I, for one – I'm really looking
it
forward
also,
to that.
It all sounds so simple, doesn't it, right? Defeat ISIS without putting troops on the ground over there. Here's a comment on Senator Cardin's decision to oppose the Iran nuclear deal. You can join us here at 410-662-8780. And if you'd like to write an email, as Drew did, it's midday at WYPR.org. Drew says, Ben Cardin had a choice, and he made the one that would allow him to remain a senator. The Jewish community in Baltimore has been largely hostile to the Iran deal, and they've made their disapproval known. The fact that Senator Mikulski voiced her approval and turned the numbers in President Obama's favor gave Senator Cardin the cover he needed to appease his electorate but not alienate himself from his party. That Senator Mikulski is not facing re-election probably made her choice much easier. A pretty astute comment there. We'll take another break and come back and take some phone calls. We'll also talk about the Republican presidential campaign, 410-662-8780. And also on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And what's Joe Biden going to do? A short break. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Max Hilaire, Richard Cross, and Melissa Deckman. Let's see. So where are we? It's September 8th. It's the day after Labor Day. Donald Trump is still the leading contender for the Republican presidential nomination. Richard
and he's
Cross.
Leading in Iowa.
And he's leading in Iowa.
Yeah.
So what do you have I talked to you about Trump? Yeah, you've been on the show.
Yeah.
We've talked a little bit about Trump.
And
so now it's like a month. You haven't been here for a month, 6 weeks.
Right.
Okay. So what are you thinking? What's going on here?
Well, I've never seen anything like it. It's an example of celebrity politics.
Yeah.
He's not someone who's part of the political class. He's running based on his brand, you know, the apprentice kind of taskmaster, you know, non-politician, hardcore businessman. And I don't think people like everything that he has to say, but they like the fact that he says what no one else will say. And I think if you've seen, there was one poll in one of the cable news networks, they mapped out every gaffe he had and every time he bounced in the polls as a result.
Wow.
So people are looking past, you know, what he said about Megyn Kelly or what he said about John McCain. And what they're seeing is this blunt talking businessman whose positions a lot of Republican voters wouldn't necessarily agree with if you look at what he said over the years. But somehow he's getting a bit of kind of unearned goodwill out of that persona that he's built as being part of the celebrity universe, outside of the political
celebrity
world.
Outside, the key word outside, an outsider. So you get some grace if you make some mistakes on your way into the nomination, right? Because you're an outsider and you don't speak the same language they do in Washington.
Right.
Something like that. Max, what do you make
of
it?
Well, I was saying to Melissa that we have a large percentage of the electorate that is not politically astute, and hence some of what Trump says resonate with a large number of people who are dissatisfied with the political class, and hence here comes Trump, who has a lot of celebrity swagger and can mobilize a large number of people around him. I mean, and what I said to Melissa and Richard before, these are the same people who are day-to-day struggling to make ends meet, but they're the ones who support Donald Trump, who is not likely to change the economic situation in their favor or make the country any better, as he predict he's going to do.
Well, no Republican talks that language, do they, really?
They don't.
They talk about raising the minimum wage. You don't hear that, do you?
You don't hear any of that. Yeah. So, and I mean, Trump has not laid out a plan that would, you know, someone could see and compare to other Republicans and say, well, you know, yeah, I support Donald Trump because he stands for XYZ. Right. He's stands for nothing. So he's a hollow candidate, and I think eventually he will implode.
Melissa, what do you think?
In terms of Trump's appeal, I think Richard's exactly right. I mean, this is a celebrity campaign. I think that, and the reason that he's able to do this is you have 17 people in a field. And so it's hard to distinguish between who all these people are, let alone what their issue positions are. I think as soon as the first votes start getting cast, as we have a more series of debates and some performers rise to the top. I mean, I've seen a bump lately with Carly Fiorina, who had a very strong performance in the first cocktail hour debate last month. But you'll see, I think, discerning voters, the people who are more likely to participate in these caucuses and primaries, will actually start paying attention to things like policies. And of course, Donald Trump is vapid when it comes to actually holding a position or even being consistent with his statements from the past. I would also just add that the Iowa caucuses really don't matter that much.
That's,
I mean,
true.
The last two winners of the Iowa caucuses were Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. And so it's disproportionately, I think, white conservative evangelical voters in that. And it's not really a prediction. I think what these early contests do is they basically winnow the field, right? So there's going to be winners and losers. As long as, say, Jeb Bush, who has been very disappointing, especially for many establishment Republicans, as long as he can come out okay, then he has some momentum. He's not expected to win. If he finishes second or third, it's like Bill Clinton
okay
in 92.
Going
he was the
forward,
comeback kid
right
in New Hampshire, and he finished third, right?
Conservative evangelical white voters in Iowa
Yes.
Voting for Donald Trump.
Yeah. I am stumped at this. As someone who has studied evangelicals
yeah
and politics for
I
years.
I know this. I'm asking you this.
In fact, if your listeners have time, there's this hysterical meme on Twitter about the Bible, Trump Bible. And essentially, every time Trump talks about religion, it is completely apparent he has no idea what he's talking about. And so basically, this little meme is about reinterpreting the Bible in ways that fits Trump's ideology. Like, there's what about forgiveness? I'll just work harder. I won't ask for forgiveness. You know, basic tenet of Christianity.
What about divorce?
Divorced three times, yes.
Right?
That doesn't seem to matter to these folks.
What God has joined, let no man put asunder, right? Isn't that in there somewhere?
Oh, yes. It's ridiculous.
Maybe they don't care about that because he's what Richard was, as Richard was describing, and Max, he's an outsider who just bluntly speaks.
He's an outsider. He's appealing to many people who for whom politics is off-putting. But if you look at some of the leaders as we get into the caucuses, as we get into toward the wintertime, if you look at the people on the ground, people who are leading like the local family research council, the local groups in Iowa on the ground, look at who they're talking to, who they're endorsing. It will not be Donald Trump. I guarantee you, will not be Donald Trump.
We'll see. Let's take a phone call. John in Parkville on Donald Trump having a plan to deal with ISIS. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I just wanted to put this back into the record, and that is that Mr. Trump has articulated a plan to deal with ISIS, and I wanted to make sure your guests knew about it and would comment on it. His plan, as told to Chuck Todd, was that he would put troops on the ground, and he would put troops on the ground to, quote, seize the oil. He would seize the oil resources that he believes ISIS controls and cut off their money supply. So he has articulated a plan, however you view it. I also want to ask your guests one other question about Mr. Trump. Could Mr. Trump attract registered voters who do not vote and thus change the political arithmetic that we have been hearing about? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you for calling. I did quickly check here. He did make a statement to
Chuck Todd.
Yeah, and it was on MSNBC, according to this story from the Fortune website, that he would use force and knock out the oil's the source of ISIS's wealth. I would knock out the source of their wealth, the primary source of their wealth, which is oil. I would knock the hell out of them, but I'd put a ring around it and I'd take the oil for our country. So there's the Trump plan.
Maybe
for ISIS.
Maybe I should add a caveat. He doesn't have a plausible plan.
Okay, all right.
Because essentially that is a non-starter.
How about appealing to vote? Okay, let's go back to the politics. Appealing to voters who do not normally take part in all of this.
Well, despite Trump's expansive ego and his charisma, I think engaging people in the process that have never engaged before is a tall order. And it would have to be more than just Trump being the celebrity guy talking about, you know, himself and kind of demagoguing on immigration. I think another thing to notice about Trump is he doesn't really have an organization that I've seen. It's just basically been him. Mm-hmm. You know, him and, you know, he's got his aides around him. He doesn't have a professional organization. Mm-hmm. They've gone to other candidates. And if you're going to have that ambitious a strategy, you need to have kind of the infrastructure behind you to back it up.
Well, one of the things I would say about Donald Trump and his strategy, assuming he wins Iowa and wins New Hampshire, I mean, politics in South Carolina, which is the second primary is held, is very different. And there's a significant African American vote in South Carolina, 40% of the electorate. And of course, it's a very strong conservative evangelical state as well. I doubt Donald Trump would make it past South Carolina.
Melissa?
The interesting story, too, is that Ben Carson is really making inroads to that more conservative. And Republicans, there are many black Republicans in the South, in South Carolina, who are voting in the primaries. So I think in the general election, that's a different thing. But we do have what's becoming known as the SEC primary, right,
yes,
in the South, like about a month after, in early March, I believe. You have about 10 states, most of which are other southern states. And that's really, I think, where we're going to get a good idea of who the eventual nominee would be, or at least we'll be able to limit. Because after Iowa, after New Hampshire, I think most of the folks are going to drop out of the GOP. And then I think people are really going to take a more serious look. In terms of people who are not registered to vote, can Trump appeal to that? I completely agree with Richard. It's a tall order to do this. And primaries, you know, you have the most committed voters, people who take the time to register to vote. Most states have closed primaries. You have to be a member of that party in order to be eligible to vote. And so Trump might have this broad appeal in some respects, to some people who may be disenchanted with politics, but I really do not think he's going to make that much of a big difference in the primaries and getting more people out to vote for him.
Okay, just one thing here. This is September. You're talking about primaries, Max and Melissa, in March.
In March. Mm-hmm.
That's a long time from now, and that means Donald Trump is going to be around sitting on this for a long time. When is the Iowa caucus?
February 1st.
February 1st.
Yes.
But this is still only September. I mean, he's going to be around leading this pack for quite a while here, unless he, you said when he messes up, his numbers go up, Richard, right?
I mean, I can't see that going on forever, though.
Huh?
I can't see that going on forever, though. At some point, he's going to hit a brick wall. I mean, just my gut telling me that.
Okay. Now, on the Democratic side, I want to ask you about this. Hillary Clinton and the email server. Okay, this story, I know, we roll eyes, this story won't go away. And it seems to be another one of these things that's going to be around for a while, because apparently it'll be weeks and months before all these emails are vetted and put out there, and there'll be different revelations coming up over the next several months. This is going to be haunting Hillary Clinton for a while. So I wonder, what does that do to the shape up of the Democratic primary? You got Bernie Sanders nipping at her here. You know, his numbers are coming up. Then there's Joe Biden sitting out here trying to make up his mind about whether to get in or not, and maybe looking to see how this email server business plays out with Hillary Clinton. So I'll start with Melissa on that.
I think the Clinton mantra is take a bad situation and make it worse. Because the weekend, she decides to apologize to the American public for essentially not understanding how this is an issue. So it was patronizing. It was a non-apology. And it has the impact of basically bringing up the worst qualities about the Clintons, right? Essentially that they believe that they are above the law. And that, I think, has the potential to hurt her in the general election. I still think right now she has too much establishment backing. She has too much money at this stage of the game for Bernie Sanders to win. Bernie Sanders might win in New Hampshire. He's from Vermont, you know. But I think Bernie Sanders is no Barack Obama. This isn't a replay of 2008. And so I would be surprised still if Hillary Clinton does not win the nomination. I mean, maybe some things will happen. Some things will actually come out that are incredibly damning. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I think at that point, Joe Biden might step in. I think at this point, he's not likely to do so.
So you're saying among Democrats, this email server thing is not that big a deal?
I don't think it's that big of a deal.
Richard?
I agree with what Melissa said. I think barring an indictment, Hillary survives this. I don't see it being anything that kind of sinks her campaign, given the resources and the advantages she already has.
Okay. Couldn't Democratic voters look at this and say, I'm a little worried that she can't beat a Republican with this stuff hanging over her?
That's true. But as Melissa and Richard said, this is not an issue for Democrats, this whole email.
I'm suggesting is that some voters may look at that and say, okay, I should vote for her. It's her turn, right? But can she beat Jeb Bush? Can she beat Donald Trump if he's the nominee?
If you look right now, go to Real Clear Politics, all the hypothetical national polls, which frankly don't mean anything. But if you look at them all, you will see in all these matchups, she's still doing better
than
these other hypothetical Republicans.
Sorry, Max.
I think Hillary is – I'm not sure she's really motivating the Democratic base, or the Democratic base is not as enthusiastic about Hillary as one would have expected at this time in the cycle. And the email scandal has not helped her. And I think the more the Republicans drag this thing on, the more it stays in the press, and then people get turned off because she really can't come up with an accurate or an answer that is going to make people say, well, okay, we accept your apology, you made an error. But I think that was a terrible, terrible mistake to make. You're working in the government.
You're
Secretary of State. You ought to have at least use the State Department email for conducting some business and keep your...
And, sir, you know, there are some 32,000 emails that are gone now, right, that can't be traced, which adds to the suspicion about it. Richard?
Well, it kind of reminds me of the incident when Bill Clinton was president, when they found the cache of FBI files in the basement. And I worked on the Hill then for Bob Ehrlich and the committee, the Government Reform and Oversight had hearings, and a lot of people made noise about it. In a month, it was gone. You know, and eventually this is going to be gone.
It may be. The bigger problem she may have is that because she's been around for a long time, right now, First Lady, U.S. Senator, Secretary of State, candidate in 2008, and now, yes, we know it's her time, so it's hard to get the base motivated because they just realize this is a fait accompli, this is the way it's supposed to be, it's her turn. Right?
Well, that, and to be honest, Bernie Sanders, I mean, he has a devoted cult following out there, but he is really unelectable. I mean, if you go and look at his issue positions, he is very, very far to the left. And he's proposing a $15 hike to minimum wage. That might sound good for a lot of people, but in the current political context, it's not going to pass. He's calling for massive infusions of cash to shore up infrastructure. Not that we don't need that as a country, but at levels that I think will never get passed in Congress. And so that's what the alternative is that's why people are so intrigued by Joe Biden, right? Maybe this is the actual the person of gravitas who could really take on Hillary Clinton. But Joe Biden, remember, ran for president twice and lost. And so I think he's popular now as a vice president, but not so much as a candidate.
Melissa Deckman is chair of the Political Science Department at Washington College, where she teaches courses in American government, religion, politics, and women and politics. Thanks for being here again, Melissa. Nice to have you.
My pleasure.
Max Hilaire, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University. If you'd like to meet Max, make a note on your calendar for September 22nd, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the James E. Lewis Museum of Art. That's on the campus of Morgan State University, where Max Hilaire is chair of the Political Science Department. Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Max.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much. And Richard Cross, nice to get you back here with us. Thanks for making time for us. Richard Cross, who worked for Bob Ehrlich, once upon a time and was a speechwriter, now writes political commentary for the Baltimore Sun and on his blog, Cross Purposes. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Stay tuned. Another hour of Midday on the way. We'll take a break here for lunch. Tuesday lunch brought to us by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. It's open daily 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with delivery available nightly 5 to 9 p.m. Bagby Pizza.